Welcome to the ninth Harry H. Barron Skype Shir to Kol Beis HaTalmud in Melbourne, Australia. Tonight's session, again, will be part two by Rabbi Loike, and it's entitled Kosher Eggs and Animals. We have received feedback from Australia that the last shir Rabbi Loike gave was amazing. And if you look at the table here, just by the looks of what's going on here, with the giraffe leg here, the zebra leg here, I'm sure that this will be an amazing shir as well. Rabbi Loike.
Thank you, Rabbi Grossman. Let's just close the door. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes.
Okay. So again, we're going to have, Bezrat Hashem, a lot of visual aids. I just want to point out that we're dealing with different kinds of materials tonight. So if, you know, some might come out more or less clearly, just help me out if you can't see what I'm talking about clearly, so I can make sure that everything is as clear as possible. The first thing that we're going to talk about tonight is eggs. Now, the eggs are much more lemaisa than the second part of the shir, which is how to identify kosher mammals. When we talk about eggs, right, we have here, I don't know if we can see it, this is a very basic chicken egg. That's not working. All right. And if you can see, it's more or less kad v'chad, right? This part is, let's see if we can do this. This part is more or less rounded. This is more or less pointed. And the bottom line, can we just center it in the picture? Yeah. A little higher. A little, you see? Okay. And if you take a look at this chicken egg, it's pretty clear. If you take a look at the Shulchan Aruch Simen Pevav, if you know how to identify a chicken egg, somebody sells you a chicken egg, you don't need anyone to certify the chicken egg, and you can be relatively certain that it's kosher. What I want to bring to your attention is that with today we have a number of technologies which have made it very profitable for companies to deal with very exotic chickens. So in addition to this chicken egg, I have here another chicken egg. This is a very common, this is a regular brown hen egg. Nothing very spectacular about it. And then I have here, you'll see this egg is spotted. Also, a run-of-the-mill brown egg. But I also have, I don't know if it's going to come out clearly on the video, I brought actually two of them in the hope that one would work. These are also chicken eggs. But if you take a look, oops, they're actually not white. They're green or blue, depending on which one you're looking at. And there are a number of chickens, which we currently raise, which if you look at them, they are either green or blue tinted, and depending on the particulars, they're more or less dramatic in terms of their coloration. Now, I don't know, can you see how this is white? This one is white, and this one are green and blue, respectively? Or do they all look like they're white? Okay, so this one is actually green, and this one is actually a little bit more bluish. You can't see the difference in the colors? Because it's very clear on our screen. Not dramatic. This isn't like algae green. You see the... Okay. So what happened was that it was always assumed that the only people who domesticated chickens and who raised different kinds of chickens were actually either the Europeans or the Asians. However, at the turn of the century, they discovered in South America a kind of chicken which is known as the Aracuna chicken. They were raised by the Aracuna Indians, and archaeologists have subsequently discovered that the Aracuna Indians had been domesticating chickens prior to the arrival of Columbus. How the Aracunas got their chicken is not clear, but what is clear is they were raising a chicken which had an anomaly not found in any other breed of chicken. And the anomaly of this chicken, aside from its general appearance, which was remarkably unchicken-like, was that it produced these green or blue eggs. When the Aracuna chicken was hybridized with other recognized breeds of chicken, they also produced chickens which looked like normal chickens, but they produced yellow or green eggs. As a result, the shaila, which was in front of all the poskim, was now that we have these red or these green eggs or these blue eggs, are they kosher? Are they permitted because we don't know if it's really a chicken. Now, as we said last time, since they breed with kosher birds and produce viable offspring, there's a lot of room to say that they're actually the same species. Nonetheless, the original Arrakuna chicken was very different than the regular chicken, and nobody's yet poskened on the original Arrakuna chicken. But what happened really in the last 10 years were a lot of chicken breeders, particularly chicken breeders who lived in Northern Europe, and we're talking commercial egg farms, they have to hire specialists to come in, and when the chicken is born, if they're raising chickens for eggs, they have to hire people to come in and differentiate between the kosher and the non-kosher chickens. I'm sorry, between the male and the female chickens. And the male chickens are discarded, and the female chickens are raised for eggs. And of course, hiring a specialist to come into your egg farm costs a lot of money. What they discovered is that the chicken, which lays the blue egg, that chicken, when it's born, the males and the females are different colors. So you can have any teenager who happens to be working in your farm differentiate between the males and the females. And as a result, the farmer saved a lot of money. So a lot of farms have been going over to these chickens. They are sold under all kinds of names. The most popular in Europe is Legbar. And in America, since we're slightly patriotic, we call them Americuna from America, but it has nothing to do with America. It's all a joke. And the bottom line is these chickens are making their way into our food. So the shiloh was, can we consider these chickens to be kosher? So Rav Belsky paskind that in the event that the chicken looks like a regular chicken, which is indeed the case with the leg bar, except that it produces a blue egg or a green egg, so then we're not choshesh, and just because in its ancestry it had an Arrakuna chicken, we're not too concerned. However, if the chicken looks very mishuna, we found these original Arrakuna chickens, and they have these feathers that grow out like a mustache. They're missing the last vertebrae, so they don't have a tail. They're very mishuna from our chickens. Rav Belsky felt to eat those chickens would not be appropriate. Not because they're specifically usher, but we have to do further research to determine if it's appropriate. And the truth is the actual Arrakuna chicken is very hard to raise, so it's not being raised commercially to any degree. The people who raise them certainly aren't eating them. So the original Arrakuna chicken, we do not accept it. We do not certify at the OU. But these eggs, the ones I'm holding in my hand actually, the way I got them was I went to the egg farm. They wanted to be certified. I took some of the eggs and then I made a hole in them, took out the yolk so we don't have a mess if I drop it. But these eggs are currently certified by the OU. And you can purchase them in America, at least, in a number of supermarkets. Most famously, Whole Foods has a lot of these green or blue eggs. And we looked at the original chicken, since the original chicken looked just like a normal chicken, the fact that it happened to produce an egg of a different color was not sufficient reason for us to invalidate the egg. Any questions, concerns, or comments? Okay, so ad kan the chicken eggs. Now you have to understand that there are a lot of other eggs which are sold, which are not so clear. I have over here, and I'm just going to remove all the eggs, except for my original, the eggs are rolling away. Thank you. The cameraman has once again saved the day. I'm just going to hold them in my hand because it'll work easier, apparently. This is a chicken egg, and this is a duck egg. And as you can see, they're remarkably similar. I have actually a wild duck egg. Don't worry, it was not poached from the wild. It was obtained legally. And if you take a look at the wild duck egg has a lot of color in it. Just let me put it on this surface because I think it'll come out better. Okay. The wild duck egg, as you can see, has a lot of color in it from whatever the duck eats, transferred to the egg. And lamaisa, the wild duck eggs do not look like chicken eggs. And if you felt them, you'd also feel that they feel very different. However, the domestic duck egg, it looks remarkably, we'll take out the dirty part. It looks remarkably like a chicken egg, and you really have to be certain that you can differentiate. On the same note, I have here something that a lot of people have been making a mistake with, which is a guinea fowl egg. And the guinea fowl egg does not look like a white egg, obviously, but it looks somewhat similar to the brown egg. We can get them both in the picture. Here we go. I'm taking away the I number all the eggs so I can remember where I got them. And if you take a look, the guinea fowl egg is sort of close to a chicken egg, but not quite. It happens to be more pointed, if you can look, and rounded than the chicken egg. And we have, regarding the guinea fowl, there is a tremendous machlokes regarding the poskim. Many Jews from the North African areas accepted the Guinea Fellows kosher. However, based on the Chasam Sofer, most Ashkenazi communities currently do not accept the Guinea Fellows kosher. And the OU obviously will not certify the guinea fowl egg since it is not the prevalent Ashkenaz tradition to consume it. There were a number of people. Well, I'll preface that by saying I've given the shir on eggs before, and I gave it in Lakewood. And before I gave the shir, I used to joke with Rabbi Grossman that there's really no point. All eggs are kosher. Why should I speak about eggs? And Rabbi Grossman kept on insisting, you have to talk about eggs. People have to learn these things. So I was giving a shir in Lakewood, and the next day people started calling me, telling me that they suspected that the eggs that they were buying at a local farmer's market were guinea fowl eggs and were not chicken eggs. And when we investigated, which wasn't very hard, we called the farmer, and the farmer told us, yes, he was selling guinea fowl eggs. So as a result of the shir, a lot of people were able to realize that the eggs that they were buying were not chicken eggs, were actually guinea fowl eggs, and as a result they were able to be to stop doing something that, at least to the Chasam Sofer, was not a... let's just say, wasn't the appropriate course of action, and might, the Chasam Sofer was actually, he writes in his tshuva, that the guinea fowl egg might be severely problematic, to put it lightly. So it's worth knowing that if you have an egg that looks like this, ask your local rabbi whether or not it's appropriate to consume that egg. Any questions, concerns, or comments about the guinea fowl? Now, the other egg that we have in America, which a lot of people eat, are quail eggs. And I brought in a few quail eggs, so just give me a second. They're very delicate, so I have to be careful when I open it. Otherwise, they go the way of the dodo, I guess is the right phrase. So here, I have two quail eggs. And these are from the kosher quail. The kosher quail is sold as either the European quail. Sometimes they sell them as Faro quail. And sometimes they sell them as Coturnix coturnix, which is a Latin name. The European quail was the same quail that the Jews encountered in the Midbar. We spoke about it. You saw the actual quail, if you remember the last time I spoke. And these are the eggs, not from that exact quail I showed you. It didn't make it. But actually from a similar, from its mother. And these quail eggs are for sure kosher. And there are a lot of people who want to eat quail eggs. And what we tell them is if you can identify the kosher quail egg, so then you can eat it. And if you're not sure how to identify the kosher quail eggs, so then, here, can we get it higher? Yeah. It's just higher on this screen, so this way. Okay. Yeah, so they can see it clearly. And these quail eggs are kosher. There's no shilas. However, there's a problem because there are 48 different species of quail in the world. At least some of them are endangered, so I'm always scared to say an exact number. Because who knows, maybe by now there's less. And we only know of one, which is the Coturnix coturnix, the European quail that we know is kosher. Fortunately, most of the quail are not raised in captivity. Well, not fortunate for the quail, but fortunate for us. However, in America, if you say that you want to buy quail eggs, they have the right to sell you either Coturnix quail eggs, or there's another quail called the bobwhite quail, which is indigenous to North America. And I have two of those eggs with me. And if you take a look, these are bobwhite quail eggs. And the bobwhite quail eggs are sold as quail eggs. You buy quail eggs, you can get either Coturnix quail or bobwhite, either European quail or bobwhite quail. It doesn't matter which one. However, the bobwhite quail we do not accept as kosher. As you can see, there's really, if a person has just a basic knowledge of quail, it's highly unlikely they're going to confuse the Coturnix quail with the bobwhite quail. Because the Coturnix quail, as you can see, is speckled, and the bobwhite quail is white. So unless the person's mamish not paying any attention, he shouldn't be confused. However, there's another kind of quail, and this is the only other kind of quail which is raised in large numbers in the U.S., and it's called the button quail. And the button quail, button is like button, B-U-T-T-O-N. And the button quail produces an egg which is much smaller, but it also has splotches. And these splotches, if you take a look, can vary. It's not consistent from egg to egg. And some of them have more splotches, some of them have less splotches. But there could be a point where someone who's not paying close attention might confuse these eggs. Now, of course, they're not so similar. I'm pretty confident that if someone takes a moment to look at them, they won't get confused either way. But the bottom line is if you can identify the Coturnix quail, the European eggs, then you can eat them. And if you can't, so you have a problem because maybe you're going to end up eating the wrong kind of quail egg. There are companies which not certified, so it's not a certified product I'm putting in front of you, but they sell cooked or hard-boiled quail eggs. And what they do is they sell the eggs peeled. So in such a case, obviously once the eggshell is off, there is no way to differentiate between the bobwhite quail egg and the Coturnix and the European quail egg. And as a result, it's severely problematic to buy those kinds of eggs without a viable certification. But as a general rule, the European quail eggs are permitted as long as you can make sure that you're not going to confuse them with the bobwhite quail eggs.
Question?
Any questions, concerns, or comments?
Yes.
Rabbi Grossman has a question.
Mike?
Yes, I just don't have a free hand.
I remember that we were asked the question from Rabbi Gutnick in Australia a number of years ago about quail there. And if I recall correctly, we responded that there were two quails that were kosher. I think you mentioned one. If I remember, it was the Japanese quail. Has something changed, or that's my question?
So the major change has been not with me, but with our counting of species. It used to be that still some people consider the Japanese and the European to be separate species. But at this point, if you look at the article that we published at the time, we presented to many shaykhtim, as well as to Rav Belsky, the Japanese and the European quail, and he looked and he said they're the same species. And of course, Rav Belsky was right, but the scientific community, if you look at the articles that have been published recently, it seems that the European quail have been so hybridized with the Japanese quail and vice versa that I'm not sure if it makes sense anymore to say that the quail that we're eating are either European or Japanese. It seems they're all the same. The Japanese quail were domesticated first, but the European quail have been hybridized into them. A lot of even the wild quail, which have been released throughout Europe, are actually hybrids between the Japanese and the European quail. So I think it confuses the matter, but the reality is that they're all the same species. And I just call them all European quail because that's what they call them here, even though a lot of the European quail that they sell in America are actually, if you go back their lineage, predominantly from a genetic perspective, Japanese quail.
Thank you.
Okay. I have...
Quail and pheasant the same
thing? No. Pheasant is huge. They're about the size of a chicken. Not the chickens I brought in, but a full-grown chicken. And the quail is, you saw how big they were, they're about the size of my fist.
So does the person ask you already buy the chicken egg
I'm listening? Sorry?
Is there a distinction if you buy eggs from a local farmer market?
So the Shulchan Aruch in Pei Vav says that if you buy eggs and the farmer tells you these are chicken eggs, so you can trust him, and you can eat those eggs. However, doing a 180, it would be highly unprofitable for a farmer to switch kosher chicken eggs with any other species since nothing is cheaper than chicken eggs. What was happening in Lakewood was a very interesting situation. There was an outbreak of Lyme disease, and Lyme disease is a very dangerous disease for people as well as for chickens, or at least the same bacterial ticks, whatever. And this bacteria is carried by these tiny insects called ticks. And once these ticks were seen as a vector for disease, people wanted to eliminate them. And surprisingly, while chickens will eat insects, the chickens do not eat insects that are as small as ticks. Guinea fowl do eat ticks. So what many farmers did to protect their flocks was they would raise guinea fowl together with their chickens. And as a result, the incidence of cross-contamination, meaning the bacterial contamination, was very much lessened, but at the same time, the guinea fowl lays eggs, so what's the farmer going to do? Throw them in the garbage? So he would sell the guinea fowl eggs together with the chicken eggs. And some of the guinea fowl became so, I don't know, successful in breeding in the farm that you had farmers who theoretically were raising chickens, but they ended up having many, many guinea fowl. So that's why there was a problem with the guinea fowl eggs ending up with the chicken. The farmer was selling chicken eggs, and he happened to have a lot of guinea fowl eggs because his business went the wrong way accidentally. And he didn't care, and nobody should have complained from his point of view, since guinea fowl eggs are worth more than chicken eggs. Who would complain if they got a guinea fowl egg instead of a chicken egg? But pheasant eggs are so much more valuable than chicken eggs, and most of the other kinds of eggs are so much more valuable, it's highly unlikely that a farmer would sell those kinds of eggs as chicken eggs. I will tell you that I have one time, and I've gone to probably at least 200 egg farms in the course of my work for the OU to look into different things. And only once I went into a chicken farm, and it smelled terrible. They always smell terrible. It's the worst smell that I have ever smelled are these chicken farms. But this one smelled terrible, but the wrong kind of terrible. So I went to the front desk and I said, "What do you raise here besides chickens?" Because it smelled it was a different smell. So they confessed that they raised ducks. And the ducks that they raised, they actually were selling the duck eggs as chicken eggs, because they were trying to get their flock large enough that they could sell the duck eggs independently. But while they were getting the flock started, they did not have enough eggs to make it worthwhile to start marketing duck eggs. So they would sell the duck eggs as chicken eggs. And I asked them why they did that, and they said, "Who would complain if instead of chicken eggs, you're getting duck eggs?" So we actually looked into it, and we discovered that these ducks were kosher, so there was no problem. But as you said, there are times that people will switch eggs for eggs. But the fact is, the consumer should know, because if you know what a chicken egg is supposed to look like, and you open a box of chicken eggs, and the shell feels differently, or it looks differently, so you should do a little research. But the assumption is that any kosher observant person, when they buy eggs, they're going to look at the eggs first, and even if it doesn't have hashgacha. And just by feeling it and looking at it, you would be able to tell if you had a duck egg, and you certainly would be able to tell if you had a guinea fowl egg. You just have to look. If you had a pheasant egg, the pheasant eggs are brown, but they're also very small compared to chicken eggs. So if someone would sell a pheasant egg, you would for sure know. But pheasant don't lay enough eggs for them to be raised for eggs at all. Guinea fowl lay a lot of eggs. Ducks lay a lot of eggs. So those might be raised for eggs. Pheasants don't lay enough eggs for it to be viable to raise them for their eggs. Any other questions? Right, this happened to be a kosher duck. He didn't want to tell me what kind of duck he had, because he had all these confidentiality things. But Baruch Hashem, it turns out that his supplier was a friend of mine. So I called up the supplier, I signed all the confidentiality, and he told me the recipe that he used genetically to derive his ducks. We looked into every one of those species, and it turns out they're all kosher. Okay? All right. Now, I have just the last point on quail. I have here something which is very common in the natural world, which is an anomaly. These quail both were raised by my flock, and this one over here is actually a kosher quail egg, but it's sort of white. Not completely, but sort of white. And that is simply the way it came out of the egg. I know the hen, I know who raised it, I know where it came out of. But sometimes you have anomalies where kosher eggs don't look the way they're supposed to. Of course, if I opened a carton of eggs, of quail eggs, and I saw this egg, I wouldn't eat it, because how do I know it's a quail egg? But this egg I would eat, because it looks like a kosher quail egg. That is it for quail. Any other questions about quail? Okay. The other egg we have here, we have a few other eggs I want to show you. Now, the poskim, the poskim as well as the Gemara talks about that there are certain signs. Okay, let's just get this in though. There are certain signs by which the kosher birds can be identified, and one of them is that kad v'chad, that they have one side which is round and one side which is pointed. Now here I have two eggs, both of which came from a pigeon. This one doesn't look kad v'chad; it looks the same. Both sides seem to be equally round. And this side, you can see one side is more pointed and one side is more rounded. And I asked Rabbi Belsky about it, and he said, again, with natural products, you can't really tell. There's a certain amount of inconsistency. And obviously, if I know this came from a pigeon, it would be kosher. If I didn't know if it came from a pigeon, so then obviously it would be problematic. But since these both came from a pigeon, both these eggs could be consumed. I also have, a farmer sent it to me, the same farmer that sent me those ducks I had on Tuesday, I guess for you Wednesday, he sent me this egg. And he made all sorts of marks. It wasn't a fertile egg, which is why he sent it for me as a gift. But it's a swan egg. I know it looks like a dinosaur egg, but it's actually a swan egg. And if you take a look, you'll notice that it also doesn't have the same shape as the kosher eggs which we had previously. It might be slightly kad v'chad, but it looks more or less, if you look at the two sides, it looks like the two sides are equally pointed. And again, we know that there's a machlokas whether or not swan is kosher. So this might indicate that swan is not kosher. You should know that this comes from a very special swan, which might be close to your heart. It comes from the black swan, which is native to Australia. So those black ruffled swans that you see in the parks, I don't know if you see them in Australia, but that are rumored to be all over Australia, this is what the egg looks like. Black swans, right? Completely black. So it's a Shiloh whether or not those birds are actually swans. But if they are swans, so they would be an indication that swans are at least halachically problematic as far as the signs of the egg. Of course, we don't have a Mesorah on those birds, so even if we got past the egg problem, we still wouldn't be able to eat them. Do we have any questions, concerns, or comments? Okay. Yes. So that is a very good question, and unfortunately, I don't know the answer. We have a tshuva from Rav Moshe, which seems to be stringent, but at the same time, there are different readings in the tshuva of Rav Moshe. The OU, as a general policy, whenever there's an uncertainty, we have no reason to do things that would make part of the kehillah uncomfortable. So because people are not clear about it, we do not certify pheasant. However, I have heard Mesorah from many people, many different communities, that pheasant is kosher. So I guess you'd have to ask your local rabbi how you want to paskin, but the OU, we don't paskin regarding whether or not it's kosher, but our decision to certify was not to certify, and that was exclusively because there were some people who were against it. But lav dafka, is there any indication that it's not a kosher species? It seems that if you look at the pheasant and you look at the Gemara, which says tarnagol fizione and tavas or kolayim zebezeh, that it's pretty clear that the pheasant is kosher. We also have in the same book that was quoted on Tuesday, the Mesorah of Livorno, they very clearly list the pheasant among the birds that were accepted as kosher. And we also have other communities which accepted the pheasant as kosher. As I said, the OU's official policy is that we don't certify birds where some communities abstained. And since there is this uncertainty how to read the tshuva of Rav Moshe, we do not certify the pheasant. Okay, if anyone has another question, we'd much appreciate it because I have to get rid of the eggs before the next part of the presentation. So I need about a minute. Any other questions? All right. Now, the next... yeah?
One more question. Is there a law for the person selling eggs that have
to... Nope. There's an indication. It's very unclear. That was the first thing I did when I found the duck eggs, is I called the lawyers, and they weren't sure that we had a case. And certainly with quail eggs, you could call either bobwhite or European quail eggs. Because they're all both called quail in America, so there's no way to say one's quail and one's not. Any other questions, concerns, or comments?
No.
Okay. Now... just focus on the bottom part. We have here the foot of a giraffe. The shaila that we have is, how do you identify kosher mammals? And really, I could tell you, less than a minute, I'm sure everybody who's gone to any shir on kosher mammals knows. Kosher mammals, they have mafris parsa, they have separate hooves, right? This is mafris parsa. Sorry. And they're also maligera, and they chew their cud. And of course, once you know if an animal is maligera, mafris parsa, you can be sure that it is kosher. The Gemara in Chul and Daf Nun Tes, what we have right here, the Gemara talks about that kosher mammals do not have upper teeth. Now, of course, being identified as separating the hooves. Right here we have the hoof of a zebra. I also have the bone. So if you take a look, you could see that this animal has a full hoof, no separation. This has a separation. Really simple. You take a look at the hoof. You can tell that this is a kosher mammal, at least as far as the hoof goes. But regarding chewing its cud, it's a little bit harder to determine how if an animal is indeed chewing its cud. So if you cannot look at the feet, and you want to differentiate, so the Gemara tells us in Chulin Daf Nun Tes, Kol behemah shemalagera, all animals that are malagera, biyadua she'ein lo shinayim lamala v'tahora. It's clear they don't have upper teeth and they're tahor. Now if you take a look, I have here, let me just take off the hoofs. Okay, I have here two animals. This is a coyote, and this is a bobcat. These are basically donations. If you're wondering how I have these skulls and why I have Dafka these skulls. So yeah, I'm not really sure why we have them either, but these are the skulls we have. So this is a coyote skull, and this is a bobcat skull. The coyote skull, unfortunately, is glued shut. Again, no idea what the history behind that is. But the bobcat skull, if you take a look, they have over here upper teeth. Right? They have these fangs, and then they have these teeth in front. Kosher mammals, according to the Gemara, again, I'll read it, the Gemara, kol behemash malagera, any animal that's malagera, biyadua she'ein lo shinayim lamala. It's clear it has no upper teeth, v'tahor, and it's tahor. So take a look. This has upper teeth, so we could say this is not, we know a bobcat's not kosher. And this, because it has, again, these upper teeth. Now, I have here the skull of a proper kosher mammal. Here, can we focus on this part? A little look. Can we put it higher on the screen? Yeah, center it because it's not so clear. Can we put the, yeah, can we, yeah, higher? No, focus on this part.
Underneath.
Yeah, okay. So if you take a look, you'll see that this is a kosher mammal, and it has no upper teeth. This whole thing is completely clean. And it, obviously, if you saw this animal, you see it has no upper teeth, then you can be certain that it is tahor. And it seems from the Gemara that you don't have to do any further research. You don't have the feet, doesn't matter. You take a look at this skull, you know this mammal is kosher. However, we have this is the only skull I have that is not real. It's too big. I couldn't handle the real one. It was just too heavy. And, you know, you try to walk around with it. It didn't work out. So I apologize. But this is a replica of an elk skull. Surprisingly, it was significantly more expensive than a real elk skull. But for my purposes, it's much better. Now, the elk skull, of course, I'm not going to, I mean, it's not real. But what it has, and this is what all elk have, it's a very good replica, is that over here, it has teeth. And the OU does certify elk as kosher. And the Shiloh was, how could we certify the elk as kosher if it has these upper teeth? And of course, from the original elk skull, which was slightly unwieldy, I do have the teeth. Okay. Do we have any dentists in the room? Oh, no dentists in Australia?
No teeth in Australia.
All right. So these are the actual teeth that, if this had been a real skull, would be right over here. Okay? So when the OU was shechting these animals, people said, hey, how could you shech them? They have upper teeth. And at the very least, if you continue reading in the Gemara talks about Nivi, which is, we're not sure what it is. It's a Machlokas Rishonim, how to identify Nivi. And at the very least, kosher animals shouldn't have Nivi either. So even if these aren't front teeth, because they're not right over here, but they're a little bit back, they should qualify as Nivi. The Gemara talks about that a Gamal has these Nivi. And the fact is that the Gamal does not have teeth all the way in front, but they're a little bit back. So we don't know what nevi are, but nevi is something that would grow over here. Wouldn't be front teeth, but they would be nevi. And these nevi, whatever they are, is something the Gemara would consider to be problematic. I spent a lot of time in the American Museum of Natural History, where they have many, many camel skulls. I'm pretty confident I was the last person in at least 200 years to go into that room. They have a room that's just floor-to-ceiling cabinets full with all these different bones of camels. And the nevi of the gamal, the camel's skull, when you take a look, its teeth that are up here are real teeth. The elk teeth are not really teeth. They don't feel like teeth, which of course you can't feel. Whenever I give these presentations, I try to pass out the teeth so everyone could feel them. And I compare them to, you know, I pass out the kosher, you know, regular, this is a lamb, its teeth, and you feel the teeth, and you could feel that the nevi, I don't know if you could see by the coloration maybe, but the nevi of the elk is very different than the very defined teeth of a normal mammal. Right? Can we zoom in just a little bit? Is that possible? Right? And actually, when they sell these, can we focus very much on these teeth? Yeah, put them both here. When they sell these nevi, when they sell these elk teeth, they sell them as ivories, not as teeth. Of course, they're not really ivory, but that's what they sell them as, elk ivory. It doesn't feel like teeth. It doesn't work like teeth. And different jewelers like to use them for different kinds of jewelry. So they have certain textile differences that allows them to be used in a way that you can't use teeth. Unfortunately, we don't really know what these are. Some people have the theory that these are not really teeth at all, not only in texture, but also in use. If you take a look at the skull, you notice how the teeth are facing forward. So it would be very difficult for the elk to use these to eat. And it's thought that these teeth are not used for consumption of food, but are instead used exclusively for whistling and for making noises. And as a result, some people say they're not teeth at all. It's not what the Gemara is talking about. Don't worry about it. But the Psak HaTohu from Rafelski is that what the Gemara means is that kosher mammals, if they have chew their cud and they have split hooves, there's no reason for further investigation. However, if you don't see the hooves and you have upper teeth, you've got to determine whether or not a hat chews its cud. And the fact is that if it has these teeth, we're not sure if it chews its cud at all. I have a much more...
I'm just going to take this out.
Interesting skull. Just give me a second so I can get it up here. And this is the skull of a warthog. And if you take a look, even though the Gemara didn't talk about it, right? And of course, the Gemara was aware of what a warthog is. These tusks come off, and you'll notice that the warthog has no upper front teeth. And I used to give, I used to have a tremendous amount of tortoise on it until I discovered that the skull was not complete. But in any case, the warthog has a different halachic ramifications for us, which is that if you remember in Hilchos Rosh Hashanah, Hilchos Shofar, they talk about the shofar that's made from a behema tmeya. And there are a lot of questions of what kind of shofar could you make from a horn of a behema tmeya. And some people, particularly some Sephardi communities, had a tradition in understanding that halacha that they meant the warthog's tusks. Because if you take a look inside the tusks, you'll notice that they're hollow. And if you made a hole over here, you could, I mean, this is a small warthog, but you could easily make it into a shofar. So although I can't tell you much about whether or not it has proper dentition, there is what to learn from the skull, because, of course, there's the halachos of shofar, and for those people that want to know how you make a shofar from a non-kosher animal, the warthog would be an excellent candidate. I'm sorry? There should have been, but what I didn't realize, so I was baffled by it. How come Chazal? Because Chazal said only a camel doesn't have upper, the only non-kosher mammal that doesn't have front teeth, it seems from the Gemara, was the camel. And it seems that if you had an animal without upper front teeth, you could assume it's kosher, especially if it had split hooves. So there would have been a lot of questions from the warthog, because it's a pig-like animal. And here it has no upper front teeth and it has split hooves. It could be really a terrible stumbling block for people. So when I saw the skull, I was like, oh no, what's going on here? It has no upper front teeth, and I thought the whole Gemara was, I couldn't understand it. So I was expressing my concern, and somebody Googled what a warthog skull is supposed to look like, and I discovered that the tip of my warthog skull, here you can look, right over here was cut off, and you could see there are holes. And right over here there were holes for teeth. And if I had a proper skull, there would actually be front teeth over there. Okay, now we have here a very interesting skull. It's also a very falling apart skull. This is called a muntjac. And if you take a look at the muntjac has upper front teeth, which are very, very clearly canines. Just to remind you what a canine is, you can see here the bobtail. And you see here the muntjac, they both have these very strong front teeth. So the question is this kosher? And I asked Rabbi Belsky about it actually today, because I got nervous before I gave shir. I never saw one of these before, I just got it. And Rabbi Belsky said, if this animal chooses to cut half split hooves, we would accept it as kosher. But just based on the skull alone, unlike the other mammals we have here, we would not be able to identify it as a kosher species. Of course, if it chews cut, split hooves, then it would. And I went to the Bronx Zoo, where they have some of these that are alive. The Bronx Zoo is the major zoo here in America. And they had live muntjacs. And from what I could see, it does have split hooves and it does chew its cud. Although, of course, you know, it's hard to get close enough to the animals to really be certain that it's chewing its cud. But it looked to me like it was chewing its cud. Question, concerns, or comments? Okay. Now, if you take a look at the Gemara, I wanted to just finish off with going over a Gemara, which a lot of people have a lot of trouble with. Of course, identification between chayas, wild animals, and behemos, which are domestic animals. There are major halachic ramifications between a chaya, a wild animal, and a behemo, which is a domestic animal. First of all, a chaya, when you shecht it, you must cover its blood. Whereas the behemo, if you shecht it, there is no obligation to cover its blood. Furthermore, the chaya, it is permitted, you are allowed to consume its fats, while as there are certain fats in a behemoth, a domestic animal, which are forbidden. So the Gemara gives us certain directives, how we could differentiate between the chaya and the behemoth. Now the fact is that we're so unclear how to use this Gemara that we're not really sure with most animals how to differentiate. There are very few mammals which we're certain are chayas. And usually what we do is when we shech the animals that we're not certain about, we cover their blood, we don't say a bracha, and of course their chaylev, their fats, we would be forbidden. The only animal which is universally accepted as a chaya is a deer. And we'll get to that in a second. So if you had a Gemara chul and daf nun tes open, you could look, follow inside. It's all the way at the bottom of nun tes amid aleph, but really nun tes amid beis. And first, the Gemara suggests that the difference between a chaya and a behemo could be identified by the tlafim, by the hooves. Domestic mammals have rounded hooves, and a chaya, this is a deer foot, I don't know if we have to get a good shot of it, has a pointed hoof. You see how the hooves are pointed? Let me try. Okay, so the deer has a very pointed hoof, while the domestic mammal does not. I do not have a cow foot. Surprisingly, I was able to find a giraffe foot, but I was not able to find a cow foot. But the giraffe foot, even though most people would say a giraffe is a chaya, its hoof is remarkably similar to that of a cow. Because you'll see, unlike the deer, which had a pointed hoof, the giraffe foot is not really pointed. There are different theories as to whether a giraffe is a wild animal or a something else. We're not really sure. It definitely has split hooves. It is accepted as kosher. The OU is willing to shecht it if someone would actually want to shecht it. But the foot of the giraffe looks much more like that of a domestic mammal than a wild mammal. Similarly, the hoof of a goat is very similar to that of a deer. in that the feet tend to be pointed. So the Gemara suggests that perhaps you could differentiate wild and domestic mammals by their feet, but the Gemara suggests that that's not the best way to differentiate the chayas, the wild mammals, and the behemoth, the domestic mammals. Instead, the Gemara suggests that you could figure out the difference between a kosher and a non-kosher, a domestic and a wild mammal based on its antlers. So the Gemara suggests that only kosher mammals at first have what's called a keren. And the Gemara says, what do you mean, a horn? Wild mammals have horns, and you can identify wild mammal just because it has a horn? That's ridiculous. The goat has a horn, and we have here a goat horn. If we could zoom in, because I'm going to point into a few. Okay. And the Gemara notes that the goat horn have a disqualification. The proper horn must be kruchot. Kruchot is a term mentioned in the Gemara, which we're not really sure what it means. It's a conflict between everybody. Ad kedei kach, it's a machlokus between Sansino and Artsko. But we basically say that the goat horn must be either rounded or layered. Okay? And the Gemara says, v'harei shor dechruchos, but a shor, its horn is rounded or layered, v'cho ba'aser, and its fats are aser, and it's considered to be a domestic mammal. So I have here out of here. Just have to move back. I have here some Texas Longhorns. And of course, if you say rounded, you could see what it means, because it means that, you could see that the horn is actually curved and round. So some would say that's what it means, that the shore has rounded horns like this. The other view, and I have here an Indian kind of cattle. India, from India. And this is a can we zoom out or have to move it back? And if you take a look, even they're required to write product of India on it, even though it's just the horn of an animal. And if you take a look, you could see how this horn is layered. There's layer on layer of keratin or whatever on the horn. So depending on which understanding you have of the proper horn of a shore, either this is a proper horn of a shore and it's all layered, or the Texas Longhorn, I have a small one actually, it's actually, I think, a buffalo horn, but it's the same idea, or it's just that it's curved. And the Gemara continues. Vehare is de charuchos. And it says, what about the fact that some of the animals have charuchos, which is notched? So a notched horn. Would be like this. And there are goats that have horns that are similar to this. But this is not a goat horn. And the Gemara says, Mefutzalos be'inon. You need to have a kosher animal. To be certain that the kosher animal is a wild animal, it is a chaya, you need what's called mifutzalos. Now it's a machlokas, Rashi and Tosfos, what is mifutzalos? Mifutzalos, the Gemara says, and this is very important, the Gemara says, v'harei tzvi, de ein mifutzalos v'chel b'mutter. And the Gemara says, but a deer does not have mifutzalos. So Rashi was under the impression that mifutzalos means branched. And this would be a case of mifutzalos. I don't know if you could see it. Okay? It's a very branched horn. Obviously, this is a three-pointer because it's smaller. I like small things that I can hold. But this is a white-tailed deer. It could have over 10 of these points. And this is called mifutzalos according to Rashi. And Rashi says, but that which the Gemara calls a deer, calls a tzvi, is not really a tzvi, like a deer, what we consider a deer in the English lexicon, but rather he identifies the tzvi of the Gemara as an sternbuck. And a sternbuck would have a horn that looks like this, which is just straight horn. like it's cut off on the, it's not, it wasn't taken off the bone properly, but it's cut off and it's just a straight bone, nothing here, no branching. But according to Rashi, this is a properly branched bone. However, Tosfos argues in Rashi, and Tosfos says that the meaning of mefutzalos is not that it's branched, but rather that it's what Rashi, what Tosfos identifies as zakufot and kfufot, bent over. So whether Tosfos would consider this to be bent over, I'm not sure. But this, which they had a very strong tradition in France, was a tzvi. This has a very curved horn, and that would be mefutzalos according to Tosfos. And that's what they consider to be a tzvi. Didn't have this kind of a super curved horn. And finally, the Gemara suggests that chadurot be'inan, which is rounded. And again, chadurot would also fit into this form over here. And the Gemara concludes like this. If you want to have an animal that you know is a chaya, you have two possibilities. The first one is it has a branch like, it has a horn like this.
Oh, are we able to get on the...
Okay, which is a this kind of horn. If it's mefutzalos, no questions. We know it's kosher. And in America, this is our tradition. Any animal that has this kind of horn is considered to be kosher. And not only is it considered to be kosher, but it's also, we don't have to worry about the chalef. And in addition, we do kisei hadam with a bracha. We had a deer farm where they used to shech these kinds of animals all the time. They were certified as kosher, not only by the OU, but all the major kashrus organizations. We did have a shaila that I asked Rav Belsky, which is this horn. And this horn is slightly branched. This is a roe deer from the Black Forest of Europe. And Rav Belsky said this kind of deer, it has might be mefutzalos, but he's not sure. But this for sure is mefutzalos. Rav Belsky is, yes. No, Rashi, just according to Rashi. And then the animal I showed you previously. So even though it has these little knobs that are growing, and they might even grow a little bit longer, the fact that it has these kinds of horns, even though it's slightly curved, so maybe Tosfos would be happy, but the fact that it's, according to Rashi, this would not be mefutzalos. You have to have something that's really branched. This, the white tail, is considered branched, and this is not considered branched. And the other way that the Gemara says that you could have it is you could have a kosher horn if it was everything. Charuchos, charukos, and chadurot, which means, if you remember, this is everything. It's notched, it's rounded, it's layered, depending how you look at it. I'll put it down. You can see it's not. Here, let's just focus on this. It's not mefutzalos. Either a kosher chaya has mefutzalos, which is branched, or it has to have all three, charuchos, charukot, and chaduros. If it has all three, which this has, it's charuchos, it's rounded, or it's layered, it has notches, you can see in between each of these things, it's layered or notched, and it's pointed, it's rounded on the top. And this comes from get it on. Oh, you have another one? No, it's not. Surprisingly, I'm not a... Okay. And here you have it. This is the horns of the springbuck. It is kosher. You can make it into a shofar if you want, but it's not as good as a ram's horn, as you know. And you can see that, as we discussed previously, this is the animal that not only does it have the perfect horns of a chaya, so we would know that we could do kisei hadam with the bracha, and we could also eat the chalef, but it also has no upper teeth. Okay. Does anyone have any questions, concerns, or comments? I have 5 minutes, and I'm opening them for questions. Ah, that's the million-dollar question.
Takes more than 5 minutes.
So, in a bekitzer, if you come from Bnei Brak, and you possibly like the Chazon Ish, the answer is definitely. And there were enough fights over that that there is no question that according to the people who follow the Chazon Ish, yes. In America, the general tradition is no. We look at something that has split hooves, choose its cut, it's kosher. The Chazon Ish is based on the Chachmas Adam. And the Chachmas Adam writes, it's enough that we don't eat all the animals. We just eat sheep, cow, and deer. And of course, the deer of the, he wasn't talking about whitetail, but a deer is a deer. So we're pretty good. Even if we follow the Chazon Ish, we don't have a problem with what we're eating here in America. However, the cows, right, the bison would be a problem, as well as the cows that they shecht in Israel, because they tend to come from South America, as well as a lot of the cows we shecht. So the answer is, most people do not require a Misora. We're satisfied if it chooses could have split hooves, but there are communities that require a Misora, and they would not be able to consume bison, elk.
And the OU's position is?
That we do consume things as long as they are split hooves, chew their cud.
And we give a hechsher on bison.
And Rabbi Gross wants to say, we give a hechsher on bison and elk, Rabbi, and elk. And in fact, we even give a hechsher from what I understand of the zebu, but I haven't been able to verify that.
What animal is it to be?
So that's the question. We don't know what it is. I'm sorry. Some people say that we know what it is. It's a specific kind of animal, that specific animal is a suffix, whether it's a chaya or a behema. But most people say it's a generic term for animals that we're not sure if it's a chaya or a behema. The bottom line that currently, I'm sure in the time of the Shulchan Aruch, they didn't have as many sveikas, but we have a lot more sveikas now. So we have a whole lot of animals that we treat as kvi. Among them, as you know, is the bison. That it's written specifically in the Shulchan Aruch that the buffalo, we treat it like a chaya and a behema.
Is it the same buffalo?
We're not sure. We don't know which buffalo it is. That when the Rabbanim got here, they knew from their Rabbanim that certain animals and certain birds were kosher.
From Europe.
Primarily, Rabbi Grossman pointed out that most of our traditions come from Europe, and primarily from Eastern Europe. Hungary, some from Germany, Poland, the areas where the people who wanted kosher came from. Well, I'm going to run out of time, but in a nutshell, I have here, which I'm sure will not come out in the video, but if it does, I have here a coin with a certificate of authenticity from Philip the Arab. And Philip the Arab was an emperor of Rome in the time of the Gemara. And he wrote on his coin, he had here a bull and a lion on his coin, which I'm sure is not coming out clearly at all. But nonetheless, the cow that he had on his coin was unquestionably, let's see if we get a clear picture of it, unquestionably a zebu, because a zebu can be identified by its hump, and there is no question that Philip the Arab had a hump on the bull that he had in his picture. Oh, you can see it. Look at that. Okay. Right.
On the left side.
Right. So you could see one of them is a lion that doesn't have a hump, which you can't even see it's a lion. And the other one is a zebu, and you could see the hump. You can't see most of the animal, but if you look closely, you see it has a hump. So it seems that in the time of the Gemara, the common powerful cattle, at least, I don't know, maybe they had two kinds of bulls. Some people suggest that if you look in the Tanakh, it says by various karbanos, shor and meri, that a shor was a regular cattle and the meri was the zebu. I don't know if that's true, but in the time of the Gemara, it's pretty clear that at least the zibu was known to Chazal. By the fact that there's no discussion of it being problematic, it's most likely, actually, if you look at the different pictures that have survived, you know, on those different mosaics and stuff, it seems the zibu was very, very common in Israel in the time of the Gemara. And probably that's what they were eating, because that's what they had. Also, parenthetically, our cattle, the non-zibu cattle, do not survive well in Eretz Yisrael because of the climate. So climactic conditions probably also force the hands of people. And it seems at the time of the Gemara, the zibu was a popular cattle. Why the Chazon Ish fought against the zibu and said it's no good, I don't know. But he said it didn't have a Mesorah. And in America, we don't have a Mesorah per se on zibu because it doesn't grow well in northern climates. And America, as you know, is a little bit northern than Eretz Yisrael. But in Europe, for sure, they didn't have zibu because it's too far north, except in southern Europe. So it's possible that we had the Mesorah, we lost it or whatever. But of course, that was the animal that the Chazon Ish felt was very problematic.
The main difference is the hump.
The main way to differentiate in a very, very old coin between a zebu and a regular cattle is the hump. If you looked at a zebu, if you Google it or something online, you'll see there are a lot of differences between the zebu and the regular cow. However, they are able to hybridize. And I will tell you a secret, that all of our cattle in this country and in your country has a little bit of zebu genetics in it. So whether or not you think you have a Mesorah for zebu, if you had red meat, I'm almost certain that you were eating zebu, even if it's not exclusively zebu. Any other questions, concerns, or comments? All right. Yes. Yes, the Shulchan Aruch talks about buffalo having the chumras of a chayim behemoth, and we know of four possibilities of what the buffalo was. One is that the buffalo was a kind of cow. This horn that I have was actually sold as a buffalo horn, but it's not from a buffalo, it's from a cow that's sold as buffalo. There's another kind of buffalo called the water buffalo, which is indigenous to, there are two kinds of water buffalo, different species. One is indigenous to Southeast Asia, one is indigenous to Africa, and both these are water buffalo. They're not cows, they're not that kind of cattle, but they're different species altogether. And of course, there's the buffalo, which we call in America the bison.
Okay, again, we could sit here, I'm sure, for hours with Rabbi Loike, and again, I'm sure the feedback will be amazing, a tremendous shiur. We thank Rabbi Loike. This brings to an end the OU's participation in the Yarchi Kala in Melbourne. We wish them a lot of atzlach in the other sessions, and we look forward to the 10th Harry H. Baron Ask OU Skype shiur with Rabbi Moshe Perlmutter, an expert on kashering, which will take place sometime in January. Have a good night and a good Shabbos. Kol Tov.